Hello, you're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast with James Abbott and Steph McGillivray.
Hello, and a very belated Happy New Year to everyone. Can't believe I'm saying that in February, but never mind. It's our monthly Art of Dying Well podcast with me, James Abbott, and my wonderful co-presenter,
Steph McGillivray.
Hello, Steph. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, yeah. February, Christmas, long gone.
Absolutely.
Feels like a distant memory, I have to say. Now, today, we have a really powerful podcast, don't we? The centrepiece is an extended interview with the BBC financial journalist, Sally Bundock. It was a real pleasure speaking to Sally. She launched the BBC's flagship business programme, Business Live, a programme that airs every weekday at 8:30 a.m. on the BBC News Channel and on BBC World News, if you want to catch that. And Sally was kind enough to share her story with us. Now, sadly, after an 8-year battle with cancer, her husband Paul died last summer. Devastating, obviously, especially when you leave behind a wife and 3 young children. But in the face of this grief, I have to say I found Sally to be strong, positive, brilliant with the kids, and in my opinion, she really gives a fantastic Christian witness. Do you want to have a listen to Sally's story?
I really do.
Well, my husband was diagnosed with incurable stage 4 cancer about 8 years ago. He and I are the same age. We're both 38. And at the time, we just had Samuel and Aaron. And Samuel was age 5 and Aaron was 3. And we were very shocked at the time because, of course, we had no idea. My husband was so unwell. It's the same cancer that Steve Jobs had. It's very unusual. It's called carcinoid tumours, and it's something they can only fix by cutting out tumours and getting rid of the cancer that way, which in Paul's case, they couldn't do. It spread too much. So we weren't sure what the outlook was. We, as Christians, were really hopeful that with God's divine intervention, we would see something miraculous, a healing or something of that nature. So with the children, we just always felt from the outset that we needed to be as open as we possibly could. We're always open about our faith with the children anyway, and we all go to church together as a family. So we just talked to them about the fact that Daddy's unwell and Daddy needs special medicine and treatment to try and get better, but also that we're praying for Daddy and we're trusting in God and we're believing in Jesus to help Daddy with this sickness. So we were with the boys right from the get-go, very open about everything, very open about appointments, about treatment. And that's how we approached it. And I think that was, looking back, that was the best way to do it because there was never any fear in them from what we could tell of what they didn't know, what we weren't telling them or anything going on behind the scenes. I think they felt like they were with us on the journey.
Were there any occasions where the kids asked difficult questions of you or both of you?
Yeah, lots of occasions, I think. But I think that's true of parenting in general. I think children ask us difficult questions all the time. And my policy and Paul's policy was always just be really honest. And if we don't know the answers, we just say we don't know the answers. And I mean, some of the questions they would ask us are things like, you know, why hasn't God healed Daddy? And that's a really tough question to answer. And I just say, well, I don't know why God isn't healing Daddy quickly or straight away, or why he didn't heal Daddy. But I do know that, you know, that God's got our best interests at heart, and he's there all the time with us through this journey. And today, right now, God is good and he's with us and he's caring for us as we tackle this problem.
Were there ever any problems in school? Did you notice any problems with relationship forming, schoolwork, any of those things?
No, I didn't actually. I think the boys have always been really secure. They've been in a real place of peace because Paul and I were always in a place of peace. And although it was difficult what we were tackling for sometimes, on several occasions, Paul had very toxic radiation therapy, which meant that he couldn't actually be near us as a family, physically near us for 3-week periods. I mean, I was sleeping in a separate room. The children couldn't sit on his lap or go near him. Now, Paul has been from the get-go, was a very hands-on dad because I work for the BBC. I do very unusual hours. So actually in the morning before school, Daddy was the only one at home. I mean, he did everything for them. So it was unusual for the boys to not be close to him, be near him. And that was tricky for them. But I think really from the age that they can remember, this has been the situation for them. So it's not unusual for them at home. And I think at school, we're in a very small primary school, and we just kept dialogue with the teachers and with everybody involved, his friends' parents. And everybody was with us in this. They all wanted us to do this as best we possibly could and see the best possible outcome.
I'm very struck, obviously I don't know Paul, but I'm very struck by the fact that he does sound like very hands-on, very positive, even in the face of all that.
He was. I mean, I have to say, I look back now not realising just how ill he was. There were times, I know, when he was in incredible pain that they couldn't control or manage sometimes. Also, he was having extreme sickness sometimes. And yet, he just cracked on and put on a brave face. I mean, I was working throughout the whole story, partly because he was self-employed and he wasn't earning an income when he wasn't working. So it was important that I kept working. We kept, our financial house in order, as it were. But he was just phenomenal, really. And he sort of drew deep from a resource inside, which I have to say was God's grace, God's peace, God's strength, all of those things. And actually, his own closeness to God was just so evident towards the end. I mean, he was a different person because of this journey.
When you were telling me about the, obviously the toxic nature of the treatment and those sort of practical difficulties of not being able to be as close as you'd like to be, did that frustrate him, not being able to hug the boys and things
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. It was a huge frustration to him. Also, I was pregnant with our third child. So the team looking after Paul at King's College Hospital in London were really concerned about the impact on the unborn child as well, this radiation. So he did find that extremely frustrating, and the boys would every now and then just leap on him, and try and climb into bed with him or whatever. It was tricky, but for us at the time it was a small price to pay, because I do believe that treatment gave him more time with us. It managed the cancer, I mean, some of the tumours were shrinking, so he was responding really well to it. So from our point of view, I mean, it was a small price to pay.
And forward winding a bit, 7.5 years or so, things deteriorated and then Paul ended up in a hospice towards the end.
Yeah, he deteriorated a lot this year, and it became clear to me and Paul that things were not normal at all. And we had a lot of help and support from a local charity in Buckinghamshire called Ian Rennie, who were fantastic, who helped us at home as much as possible in terms of support and care. But he did end up in hospital care and then hospice care for 10 weeks before he died. The care was amazing, but also even his medical team were not really across how ill he was. I mean, we were told in the May of this year that the cancer hardly had progressed. He died June the 30th. And when he died, it was clear actually it had gone rampant. So, we were not prepared in many ways for what was to come. We were not given any kind of time frame at all. We were very much in the dark in many ways. But towards the end, I was told time and time again, you've got hardly any time. It's a week, it's a couple of weeks. My husband and I were absolutely transfixed with prayer, with our faith, with our trust in a miraculous God, in a healing God. And so I was kind of closing my ears to all those voices. And so was he. But he got extremely ill at the end, and he got an infection at the end. And so he actually went home, which at the time was extremely difficult to digest. But it was a huge relief as well, because his body was so, so sick.
Do you know what I find amazing? Listening to you talking positively about faith under these circumstances, where you've lived life and you've both continued to live life right up until the very end for Paul. Some people, even myself when my brother died young, started to question things. I personally found it took me the other way. I got a bit closer to God. Tell me a little bit about what it did to your faith.
Well, I think it's difficult now. I'm still going through it. I'm still trying to make sense of it all. And I'm aware that I probably will never make sense of it. I think for me, the fantastic thing about our faith is, as I explained to the boys, when Paul was in the hospice, and clearly he was extremely sick. I mean, the boys obviously are seeing their daddy every day in there, and they can see the difference in him. And, I said to the boys at the time, I said, okay, boys, whatever happens now, it's a win-win. This is as bad as this is going to get, because either daddy's going to get better and he's going to come home and we'll help him get stronger here, or he's going to go to heaven and be with Jesus. And if he goes to heaven, he's going to have a brand new body, pain-free, disease-free. He's going to be in a place that is way better than we can even conceive or imagine. And we'll join him when it's our time. So I sort of prepared them that way for whatever the outcome might be. But that's absolutely what I believe in my heart, that Paul now is just having the most awesome time. And, you know, when it's my time and the kids' time, we'll be there too with him. And that's the good news of believing in Jesus Christ. You know, death has lost its sting because of the price he paid on the cross. We do have eternal life. And I think I was looking for Paul to be with me now and, you know, for us to have a long life together in retirement and all that sort of wonderful stuff you dream about. But I'm realizing that, you know, actually this life we're experiencing here is really a blink of an eye in comparison to our eternal story. And so I'm sort of coming to terms with that. In terms of my questions about God and all that stuff, well, you know, when people come to me and tell me that this person's sick or that person's sick or whatever, I do think to myself, well, you know, I've been praying for 8 years. I didn't get the outcome I was looking for, but, you know, God is God, you know. I still believe in him. I still trust him. I still look to him. I still see his amazing grace every day. I still see him answering my prayers. That prayer, no, not the answer I thought I was going to get, wanted to get. But, you know, in time I'll understand. In time I will realize what it's about. I mean, it says in the Bible, doesn't it? We just see a dim reflection in a mirror. We don't see the full story.
That's incredible. Just in terms of some of those practicalities, you know, the pain and the grief, which is there no matter what, how did the boys cope after their father died?
Well, I think we handled the whole thing extremely well. When Paul actually died, I was actually with him on my own in the hospice. It was on a Friday evening, and Paul's identical twin brother was with my boys. So I rang up Paul's brother and I said, bring the boys here. And we all had time together in the room with Paul, and I told the boys to just climb on the bed, give him a huge hug, say your goodbyes, because one thing that they couldn't do was hug their dad, because he was in so much pain, especially around the liver where the cancer was. So they all did that. They shed some tears. They were upset. But we all prayed together. We all thanked God together. And then I left my brother-in-law behind to sort of do all the kind of admin and the clearing up and all that kind of stuff. And I went out with the boys. The four of us went out for dinner. And we had a big chat together. And my youngest son, who's six, he said, you know what we should do, Mummy, when we get home? I think we should break bread together as a family. I said, you know what, Tom, that's such a great idea. That's something we would do as a family anyway, the five of us, when Paul was alive. We did that quite regularly as our own sort of prayer time and thanks to Jesus. So when we got back to our home, we all broke bread together, the four of us, and then, you know, they had a bath and they went to bed. And then we had a really lovely weekend together. And I think the boys are so at peace with where their daddy is. They really know who Jesus is because they've grown up. We've talked about him. He's a part of our everyday world. That I think they're really okay with what's happened. And there'll be times when they will be very, very sad he's not physically here to see them in the nativity play or watch them cross the finish line in the race or see them get their graduation or whatever it might be, walk down the aisle at the wedding. There's going to be those events and those big things that they will wish he was here. But ultimately, they are absolutely at peace about his story and how things have gone for him. I think when they grow up and they're adults, they will go over it again and they might have, you know, a bereavement process to go through. But at the moment, they are just doing so well. And I'm really pleased with how they are. But I know we've got an army of family and friends praying for us all the time. And I know those prayers are being answered. So that's a big part of it as well.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a testament to yours and, of course, Paul's parenting. That's wonderful. I did want to finish with one odd question. Now, you're sort of, as an experienced business news anchor and journalist, slightly public property, you know, social media, we know it's there. It's, you know, you have a persona. You're obviously very public in that sense. I did notice you put a very dignified tweet out in June. You didn't name your husband as the person who had died. I thought that was wonderful. But how do you cope with that public property side when you yourself and your children are trying to grieve?
Well, the reason I didn't name Paul in my tweet was because I didn't want it to become my story or me sort of desperately trying to get everybody's sympathy and empathy. It wasn't about that. I just wanted to explain to the viewers why I was not on screen and that I would be coming back. And people have asked questions since. I'm extremely open with people, especially here at the BBC. They have been magnificent in their support and care. And I'm really open with my colleagues because prior to Paul dying, I was open with them about our faith and our trust that he wouldn't die. So that as well is quite a sort of difficult sort of scenario to work through. But I'm just really, really open. If people ask me, they ask me. I mean, I did a conference, for example, in October in Norway, and there was an audience of 7,500 people. And I was interviewing Will Smith, the actor from Hollywood, for an hour. And we were talking about his movie Collateral Beauty, which came out in 2016, which is all about bereavement. And in the film, he plays a father who's lost a six-year-old daughter to cancer and how he really doesn't cope with that journey. So as part of that interview, I told him about my husband and I told him about our situation and how me and the boys watched his movie and how we felt about his movie in the light of our loss. And so following on from that, of course, that then leads to lots of questions and tweets and social media conversations. But I'm very open about talking about it, but I'm not sort of putting it out there as, you know, this is my story, because I'm very conscious that we are all going to die and we are all experiencing this in one way or another. And so it's everybody's story. It's not my story that I want to sort of shout on the rooftops about, if that makes sense.
And finally, Sally, some people might not be able to handle it quite as clearly or as well, if well is the right word, as you and Paul did. What would you say to another mum or even another dad that's looking at the very same situation and just a little bit beside themselves and really not knowing where to start with it?
Well, I have to say that for Paul and myself, if we did this without a loving God, a caring God, a providing God, a God of strength, I have no idea how we would have done it. And I really don't know how well we would have done it. And I really give God the glory for how well this journey has been. And I'm on this journey now for a while to go still, as I'm very aware, and the children are. So we have been honest and we've been open and we've asked for help everywhere and anywhere. Where people have been alongside to support us, we've thanked them and we've grabbed it with both hands. And that's been brilliant for the children as well, because they've had this huge support around them of us, our family, extended family, friends and neighbours, our church family. So that's partly why they're feeling so secure, because they're not alone in this. It's not just me and them now. We're a part of a big family who are all caring and loving in this situation. And I would just say, don't be fearful and don't worry. The Bible says, do not worry about tomorrow. It's brilliant advice. It does not help you in any way whatsoever. And just keep your eyes fixed on the good. I kept my eyes firmly on Jesus. What does he say about my situation? What does the Bible say about my situation? And I stopped listening to everything that was negative and that was going to fill me with fear or concern. To a degree, that was the doctors. You know, I'd listened to what they had to say. Obviously, it was very important what they have to say. And we did follow their advice to a great degree. But we kind of attacked it with, you know, with medicine, with prayer, with faith, and with our own sort of strength and love. And we got to where we are. And that's the best advice I can give. But just be really kind to yourself. Try not to worry. And please don't allow fear to creep in.
Wow. Well, what a positive, brave and uplifting piece from Sally, just 6 months after she lost her husband, Paul.
Yeah, it's hugely inspiring. And I think in a way, hearing that, and I hope others who hear it will be given hope and courage to be able to not only face such a difficult situation, but also afterwards to, you know, pick up the pieces again and keep going.
Yeah, and a positive, I mean, as a parent myself, such a strong positive example of parenting in the face of, you know, such a difficult thing.
Absolutely.
Very, very moving. Big thanks to Sally there for sharing that story with us. Now, Steph, I think before we move on to death chatter, why don't we offer our listeners just a few ways to keep tabs on us here at the Art of Dying Well podcast?
Why not subscribe to the Art of Dying Well podcasts? Just search for the Art of Dying Well on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn.
So there you have it. Yes, please do subscribe. Stay in touch with us here. Steph, you know what it's time for?
I sure do, James. Death Chatter. It's just a chat about death.
So, Steph, I thought for Death Chatter this month, really picking up on something I listened to, and I know you did as well, last month, a speech in the House of Lords by Tessa Jowell, the former MP, former Culture Secretary, Minister for the Olympics. She was diagnosed with an aggressive brain tumour in 2016 and gave, well, I think a wonderful, very dignified, very moving speech in the House of Lords. That was on the 25th of January, all about her battle with cancer. She called for a more international collaboration in terms of cancer research and talked about how vital it is, in fact, to have a supporting, caring community around you when you're suffering in this way. I think we should talk about this, but first of all, I have to play this out. She made a really profound point, and I think we should listen to it.
In the end, what gives a life meaning is not only how it is lived, but how it draws to a close. I hope that this debate will give hope to other cancer patients like me, so that we can live well together with cancer, not just dying of it.
I mean, what a strong point to make there. And really, it's like the sort of thing we've been saying for over a year now on the Art of Dying Well project.
Absolutely. It's sort of central to what we've been talking about, but also just shows you in a way how people are thinking about this differently now. And to have someone like Tessa Jowell, such an inspiring woman, so brave and strong, to go and say this on a real sort of national platform is fantastic, and I think will really help to change the way we think about death and dying. But also the point that she makes earlier in her speech, but also in the clip we've just heard, where she says, you know, we must live well together with cancer, not just dying of it. It really makes you think about people who are dying. You know, it's a very isolating feeling, and sometimes they might feel excluded from society. They might feel like, you know, they're treated as though they're not worth what a healthy person might be worth. And this just sort of goes to show you how important relationships are throughout life, but also at the time of dying and death, and that you can have really great, healthy, good relationships with your family, with your friends, with your colleagues, but also, as we heard in Sally's interview, with God. And, you know, saying that it doesn't have to be a terrible experience, and you can get stronger in ways which, you know, while your physical strength might be failing you, but you can become stronger in other ways.
I think so. And it's very interesting, in, as you say, with the interview with Sally, but also the clip we heard from Tessa Jowell, that at the point of diagnosis, you know, it's important, isn't it, not to see it as a death sentence and then to start slowing everything down or, you know, as you said, writing people off at that point. It is simply a diagnosis and probably a time to start living well, let alone to stop.
Absolutely. In a way, it sort of promotes a better attitude towards life in general by having a better attitude towards death. And, you know, it doesn't have to be one or the other. You can still be living while you are dying.
Yeah, and you know, I suppose sometimes we all look at friends, family and others when we find out they have a terminal diagnosis and sort of adjust the way we treat them.
Sure.
In a sort of sympathetic way rather than a sort of honest and life-giving way at that time.
Absolutely. And I think that in that sense, you know, one of the things which we've heard with lots of the people we've spoken to through these podcasts and through the Art of Dying Well in general is this message that, you know, the dying are still with us. And the fact that having a good relationship with them, in the sense of talking, as you say, talking openly, honestly, saying I don't know what to say to you rather than saying nothing, is actually much better. And we hear with Sally, and I know that our view from the chaplain's chair will also touch upon this, in terms of the way we include children in learning about death and dying, and make sure that it's something which is natural to them and not, you know, kind of a big scary dark thing that you have to face when you're old, because we all know that unfortunately it doesn't happen to only old people. And and to kind of normalize it in a way through healthy relationships with children, with each other, you know, with their schools and everything, it's a really huge step towards achieving this aim of living well while dying.
Yeah, definitely. And you're right, we do not know how long we have, any of us. It may not be an illness, in fact. You know, we talked about sudden grief, didn't we?
Some months
back. A sudden loss, rather. So, yeah, you really don't know how much time you've got. And as you say, I was very moved, actually, by the Sally interview, but also by Tessa Jowell when she's saying she's not afraid.
I know.
It's such powerful stuff.
Oh, it was. It was so moving. And it just, you know, it was moving, but I felt stronger just by listening to her. Mm. And I thought, wow, that is really, you know, I feel like she's really set a standard in a way.
I don't know about you, but every time, you know, we have these interviews or we listen to these wonderful, powerful speeches, I do reflect on my own mortality. Mm. I do think, if that was my diagnosis, would I not be afraid? Would I be thinking, well, hang on, can I put my best foot forward? How can I think about other people? You know, I find it just remarkable because I don't know. I hope so, but I'm not sure. But this all sort of reconciles me a bit to the end.
Yeah.
I don't know about you.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you, actually. And being involved in the whole Art of Dying Well project has definitely made me think about it. And I don't know what I would be like. I would like to think that I would be brave and courageous and, you know, but I think it takes a long time to get to that point. And that's also an important thing to understand. You know, we speak to these people who have achieved amazing things, but I think it is a very long process to get to that point where you are at peace with it, or if not at peace with it, then able to talk about it at least and actually even acknowledge that this is your reality.
Yeah. So what's our conclusion? I suppose it's everything we've been trying to achieve over the last year, 18 months, breaking down the stigma, addressing the taboo of death and dying.
Mm.
So I think it is now time for a little bit of spiritual reflection, don't you?
I totally agree. I'm ready. The view from the chaplain's chair. You might remember this voice that's coming up in a minute from a while ago. It's Sister Liz Farmer. This time we spoke to her about children and the grieving process. Really the way that children are told, or in some cases not told, about death and dying, and how they can be involved in the processes, you know, the funeral, bereavement and grief, in ways which will be helpful to them.
No, I think it's terribly important for them to be involved. They don't have to know the gory details about what Daddy's suffering from, but they do need to know that Daddy's not well and that he's having special treatment. They need to be close to that person who's sick, because their young life can give life to the father. I'm using father. You know, it could make them sad, and as much as, well, if I don't get better, I'm not going to see little Johnny grow up. But it can give a lot of comfort. Well, this is what I have. He is going to live on. He's going to be here to help my wife when I die. I know in the old days it wasn't good. I wasn't told about my own grandparents dying, and it took me a long time to get over that. But there was one wonderful example of one of our older sisters in Liverpool. Granny had died, and it's still the ritual of having a wake. So the body's brought in the coffin by the window, and the little kids were told not to go anywhere near the front parlour, because that's where Granny was. And so they did a big steer around it. And Sister Dimpner went in this day and said, oh, where were the children? And they said, oh, they're out playing. But have they seen their granny? Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, but that's terribly wrong. Get them in. So the two oldest were brought in, the other three were left out. And they came in, and little in awe of Sister Dimpner in her veil and everything. But Dimpner said, "Have you been to see your granny?" And they said, "No." And she said, "Come, I'll take you." "No," my mum said, "you come with me." So they went in, and she said, as they got near to the coffin, "Now, I'm going to lift you up, and I want you to put your hand very gently onto Granny's forehead. It'll feel terribly cold, but I want you to remember as you touch her forehead, that is the nearest you'll ever be to touching God." Well, I tell you, it worked like a dream. And when I went as palliative care nurse the next day to do a bereavement visit, there was a queue and maybe 8 or 9 kids outside this tenement block of flats wanting to come and touch God. So you just never know what the way is. But I do think children have to be given the credit for being concrete, loving children and wanting to know and to be with their parents or whoever it is that's dying, and to know their place in their world.
And just quickly, with the other little story, sometimes kids have quite a matter-of-fact way of looking at things, don't they, with the 50 p's. Tell us a bit about that.
That was a young fireman who died very sadly in Liverpool, and his two daughters. One was 6 just coming up for 7, and the other was 7 coming up 8. And when he died, one lot wanted him to be buried in his heavy metal outfit, and his heavy metal T-shirt. And, of course, the fireman insisted he had to be buried in fireman gear. But the kids weren't worried about that. What they were worried about was, what would it be like for Daddy? So one said, "I want to put 50p in his pocket. Is that all right?" And I said, "What do you want to put the 50p in for?" "Well, we don't know that he doesn't want to come back." And then the other one said, "Well, I want to put 50p in the other pocket because there might be footy up there. We just don't know, do we?" So they were all playing their part because they'd been part of the story. They knew what was going on. They knew that Daddy was going to go away and they wouldn't be seeing him for quite a long time until they made the same journey. But the fact that they knew Dave was on a journey and that journey was going on did seem to bring them comfort.
Oh, wow, that really fits, doesn't it? Mm. The children wouldn't see Daddy again until they themselves were on the same journey, which in a very beautiful way is exactly what Sally said.
Definitely. And I think, you know, Sister Liz always tells stories in such a beautiful way. The first story she told about the children being able to touch God, you know, or that was as close to God as they would be. I just thought that actually changed the way I think about some things. And, I thought she's wonderful.
I tell you, I think this has been something of a journey of a podcast.
It has.
So it's been one of those that's really impacted on me personally, actually.
Me too.
You know, I'm not a casual bystander in this particular podcast, I must say. And on that note, Steph, we must gracefully depart.
We must.
February's podcast. Did you enjoy that?
Enjoy
is a strange word, isn't it?
I always enjoy it, James.
I always do the little encouragement at this point, Steph, that if you want to get in touch with us, you can do it the usual route, the social media route, at Art of Dying Well, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and email. I must admit, we could do more emails, couldn't we, Steph?
We could.
theartofdyingwell@gmail.com.
Or you can also get in touch with us via the website, artofdyingwell.org. There is a contact us there, and I personally will be receiving your messages from that.
Now, if you can't be encouraged by that direct contact with Steph McGillivray, then I don't know what's wrong with you. Anyway, we will be back with another Art of Dying podcast in the very near future.
Bye.